We're going to try to do a Taras HaMishpacha review in three sessions. So it's somewhat ambitious to do that. I'm also never sure exactly how to do a review, meaning what level of knowledge do you assume? My experience in answering questions is that the levels of knowledge, just even within a somewhat homogeneous community like ours, varies greatly in terms of how people were prepared or what they remember exactly from learning before their weddings, and I guess just based on what kinds of experiences they've had since then and how many of these questions have come up. So I'm gonna, you know, certainly give me feedback in terms of if it's too basic, too complex, or anything in between, and if there's any topics that you feel like I'm not covering that maybe are more practical. I figure if we have three sessions, the way we should split it is as follows, that the first session is going to be, we'll go in chronological order, what makes a woman a nida in terms of on a daraisa level, in terms of ksamim, what the various leniencies are when it comes to stains that are found on begadim, and in terms of gynecological procedures and things of that nature. Then the second one is going to be about once a woman is a nida, what are the behaviors that are limited or limiting between husband and wife, what we call harchakos. And maybe at the end of the harchakos, we'll also discuss some issues relating to vestos, meaning predicting when the next time she's going to become a nida. And then on the third time, we'll get to the preparation for the mikvah, going to the mikvah, delaying mikvah, all of those kinds of issues. That sound reasonable? Did I skip anything major that you think like should be on that list that's not? Okay, sounds good. All right. You remember, okay? So hopefully we'll cover most of the things that we're supposed to cover. By way of introduction, whenever I teach chasanim, I always tell them. Well, first I tell them they should take a lot of Shalom Bayis lessons, but after that, I always tell them that the halachos of nida, while certainly to young people who are first getting married, sounds very strange. It sounds completely different than kashrus and shabbos and every other area of halacha that they've ever learned before. Sometimes, because of our experiences growing up and our exposure to society around us, we have a certain view of a man-woman relationship that is completely warped and not really correct, and certainly not holy. And Hilchos Nida takes this most sensitive and private relationship between husband and wife and really makes it very holy. And there are a lot of really wonderful messages and ideas and hashkafos behind it, and not the least of which is that the marriage relationship is a critical relationship that has so many different elements, and the halachos of nida sort of allow you to isolate different elements and work on them at different times. We say in the Shavuot Brachos, Reyim ha'ahuvim, Reyim and Ahuvim translate differently, and they refer to different elements of the relationship. Reyim is friendship, Ahuvim is lovers, and those are very different elements of the relationship. And it allows a couple the opportunity to grow in the different areas at different times of their lives together. Nevertheless, leaving out all of the beautiful ideas and messages about marriage and about what observing this area of halacha does for a marriage and how it's good and beneficial, fundamentally, what we always have to keep in mind is that we observe these halachos because God has commanded them. They are in the Torah, and ultimately that's why we observe all of the halachos. So there may be times where, you know what, it doesn't feel all that beautiful and nice and Reyim Ahuvim like, and it feels just more frustrating and maddening, and you know, why is this keep happening, or things of that nature, where people struggle with different. And at the end of the day, that's where our emunah comes in. That's where the fact that we are servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's something that we have to deal with and be moser nefesh for, the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects Jews to be moser nefesh. And just in case we feel like sometimes we are being so moser nefesh, it's kedai to remind ourselves what previous generations had to go through in this area of halacha, in any area of halacha, Shabbos for sure, you know, how people had to lose their jobs every single week in order to be able to observe Shabbos. But in this area of halacha, I'll just share with you one story. If you look at Rav Moshe Feinstein's family, at his children, Rav Moshe Feinstein had two daughters who have both since passed away, and two sons who are both alive. And the daughters were much older than the sons. There was like a 4 or 5 year gap between his younger daughter and his older son. And I heard from a very trustworthy source that the reason there was such a significant gap between his younger daughter and his oldest son was because Rav Moshe was a Rav in Russia, and they had a mikveh in the community, but it was secret. The communist government could not find out about it. They would shut it down, and the Jews would not be able to use it. And Rav Moshe figured, he and his Rebbetzin realized that if they were to continue to have children, the government would recognize that there must be a mikveh there somewhere that is being hidden from them. And they would search for it and they would find it. You see, if everyone else would continue to have children and the rabbi wouldn't, they would figure they have successfully rooted out religion from the community, and it's just the rabbi who's staying, the rabbi and the rebbetzin, who are staying loyal to their faith. But if even the rabbi and the rebbetzin are having children, they're going to realize that there must be a mikveh there, and they're going to find it. So there was a mikveh, but Rav Moshe and the rebbetzin decided to take one for the team and to not use it for 4 or 5 years, so that the rest of the community would be able to observe these halachos and continue to live this critical element of a Jewish lifestyle. So in terms of our Mesiras Nefesh, not to make us feel small, but to appreciate greatness, when we see it in terms of the Mesiras Nefesh that people have gone through, that great people have gone through, it's something that's worth keeping in perspective sometimes when things get frustrating and when it gets a little bit annoying, when things don't go our way in this area of halacha. The other thing I like to tell my chassanim before we start learning the halachos is that, and this is something that I think probably through years of experience, almost everyone here realizes, that it is worthwhile to have a person who you go to for your questions on a somewhat consistent basis. That when you have questions, that you're not always running from one person to the next, because very often knowledge of the person helps in dealing with Hilchos Nida Shailas. Now, that person has to be a very competent person. That person, as Mori Varabi Rav Willig points out, should not be a person who only knows Hilchos Nida, because if you only know Hilchos Nida, you cannot paskin halacha in anything. If you only know Hilchos Shabbos, you cannot paskin halacha in Hilchos Shabbos. That's clear. A person has to have a broad knowledge of how halacha works in order to paskin these halachos, but also a person has to have a knowledge of the couple, of what their basic level of religious observance is, what kinds of personality traits they may have. Just to take a very simple example, the way you would answer a question to someone who suffers from OCD is going to be very different than the way you would answer a question to someone who does not suffer from OCD. And if you call some sort of a hotline or something like that, they have no way of knowing. They can't deal with that information. So it's not like there's a halacha that you have to ask the same rabbi every time. There's no such halacha, but it's certainly advisable to develop some sort of relationship, or someone who knows your family or who knows your history a little bit. I tell my chassanim, you don't have to go with your kala, like the first community you live in when you get married, and stick with that rabbi no matter where you live the rest of your life. But wherever you go, you should have someone that you're comfortable with going to ask questions to. Those are the basic background before we begin learning any of the halachos. Now, I do want to mention that feel free to ask questions at any point. But as I laid it out at the beginning, you know, we're going to be discussing today what makes a person a nida, and therefore during this shiur, maybe let's not ask questions about harchakos and are you allowed to pass this if there are, you know, friends there, things. We'll save those questions for when we talk about that topic, and the questions about tevila and chatzitza and things of that when we talk about that topic. So questions definitely welcome, but much preferred if the questions are sort of on the topics that we're discussing. Okay, so let's review some of the basics. God gave us the Torah. Okay, that's very basic. In the Torah, it says that a woman can become tameh in several ways, and a man can become tameh in several ways. One of the ways that both a woman and a man can become tameh is called ziva. For some reason, ziva doesn't exist for men anymore. It's very clearly described by Mishnayos and Masechta Zavim, what exactly happens physically, and it just doesn't happen. It's some sort of disease that simply doesn't occur anymore in men. Now, ziva, when it comes to women, though, may still happen, because the way it presents itself in a woman is very similar to the way nida presents itself in a woman. Meaning, the Torah tells us that there are two separate ways that a woman can become tameh. One is through nida, and one is through ziva, but they present themselves in exactly the same way. Through blood, and it's the same color. It's unlike by a man, where there are different colors for Tumas Keri and Tumas Ziva. It's exactly the same. And because it's exactly the same, that caused a great deal of confusion. Already in the times of Chazal, a woman would never know when she should follow the rules of being a Zava, and when should she follow the rules of being a Nida. So what we call Nida is really our sort of combination of the two. What we do nowadays is we say, since it's impossible to know, is this ziva, is this nida, we take the chumras of all of them, put them together, and say, we're going to assume the worst. We're going to assume that it's the worst of the two. Now, what is the worst of the two? The halacha is by nida in the Torah, that, and can you imagine if we still had the halachas of nida the way the Torah originally said it, the halacha is that if a woman sees blood, if a woman becomes a nida, she is tameh for a total of 7 days. If her period lasts for 1 day, for 5 days, for 6 days, for 7 days, it doesn't make a difference, tameh for a total of 7 days. When those 7 days are over, she goes to the mikveh, and she is perfectly tahora. That is the laws of nida as it appears in the Torah. But as we said, there's also another halacha called zava. Zava is that if a woman, and I'm going to simplify a little bit, but if a woman sees blood for 3 consecutive days during certain times of the month, which are nearly impossible to calculate, which are impossible for us to calculate when those times of the month are, but during certain times of the month, if she sees blood for 3 consecutive days, she becomes what's called a zava gedola, and then she doesn't just become tamei for 7 days, she needs what's called shiva nekiyim, 7 clean days. And that is, and therefore, we assume that a woman is always a zava gedola. Whenever she's tamei, zava gedola is the automatic assumption. Even if she didn't bleed for 3 straight days, we automatically assume zava gedola, and this goes back to the times of the Gemara. This is not the kind of thing that we can sort of negotiate through. Oh, maybe I'm really only a nida and not a zava. We don't even go down that road at all anymore. The Gemara says that this was an innovation of the Bnos Yisrael. This was something that women accepted upon themselves in the times of the Gemara. This was not introduced by the rabbis, but it was introduced by women and rabbinically approved over the course of centuries, that afilu ro'os tipas dam kechardal, that even a tiny drop of blood, and the chiddush of that is, even though it's not 3 days in a row, shiva nekiyim are necessary. 7 clean days are necessary. We're going to see, not next time, but in 2 times, that it's more than just shiva nekiyim that are necessary. There are a whole bunch of other safeguards that are necessary and what to do during those shiva nekiyim. But to assume that a woman is a zava gedola, that's an automatic. So much so, it's such an automatic, that when the Gemara talks about what a person should do right before they daven, the Gemara says that, you know, right before you daven, a person is supposed to try to reorient their minds to focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's very hard to do that if right before you daven, you're thinking about other complicated matters. You're thinking about things that take up a lot of mental brain power. Or it's very hard to do if you're involved in something that's what we would call schok v'kalus rosh, something that's extremely lightheaded or frivolous, or it's just very hard to get serious after that. I remember as a kid in camp, when I was a teenager, my head counselor at the time became my boss for 17 years, actually, Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky, and right after night activity, which was typically somewhat firmly in the category of schok v'kalus rosh, he would get up before Maariv, and he would say, let's just take a minute, everybody. We're just going to be quiet for like a minute or two, just to reorient ourselves and think about davening. So the Gemara says, so what kinds of things are you allowed to learn right before davening? What kinds of things don't get your mind going and aren't questionable, are just like straight out, or something that's clear and obvious and nothing to question? So the Gemara says, oh, you know, I would have answered, thou shalt not kill. What's there to ask? Don't kill. Right? Something pretty simple like that. The Gemara says, no, what is so straightforward, so clear, that we would never ask a question on it? Benos Yisrael hechmiru al atzman shafilu roz tipas dam kechardol yoshua selesha v'nekiyim, that the Benos Yisrael took upon themselves this stringency that we observe 7 clean days, even if they only saw a small amount of blood. So why does the Gemara pick that of all the examples of what you should learn before davening? The Gemara used that to try to express to us how this is not the kind of thing we can negotiate with. This is not a questionable thing anymore. This has become an absolute. There's no posek, in maybe one, but in the course of the past several centuries, who ever even entertained the possibility of using this as a leniency. Good, so that's clear. Now, how does a woman become a nida is very complicated to translate into modern terms, because the Gemara, you know, it's one thing, sometimes you learn a Gemara about anatomy or about something scientifically related, and you know that the modern science clearly says something different. And sometimes, you know, you question, did they not know the science? Were they just working with the best science that they had at their time? But sometimes it's obvious that they weren't mistaken. Things must have changed, because there are some things that were clearly observable. They had human beings that they could ask and that they could speak to who experienced things. And they clearly, things have changed. One of those things that has clearly changed is that the Gemara assumes, in order for a woman to become a Nida on a Doraisa level, she has to have what's called a Hargasha. That she has to have some sort of, not just blood coming out, but a sensation that comes along with the emission of blood. What kind of sensation? 3 different opinions in the poskim. Now, how could there be 3 opinions in the poskim? Just ask women what they feel when they become a nida. And the answer is, because they don't feel anything when they become a nida. There may be signs in advance, and every woman is different. But there's some hargasha at the moment that the blood is leaving the uterus, not even leaving the body, at the moment that it's leaving the uterus, there's a sensation that the Gemara assumes appears or is felt by the woman. So the problem is, we don't have... For example, what are these sensations? So 3 opinions in the post. One opinion is she feels her uterus opening. Now, I would bet that if we were to take a poll of, I don't know, 1,000 women and ask, you know, what does it feel like when your uterus opens? You know, like, you know, she might say, I don't know, what does it feel like when your kidneys function? I mean, it's an internal organ. You don't feel something like that functioning. You don't feel anything when something like that happens. So, but apparently, they used to be so in touch with people in general used to be so in touch with themselves and with their bodies and with what was going on in their bodies that they would feel something, they would be cognizant of something like that. Or another possibility is that she feels nizdaza gufa, that a body tremor, that the entire body shakes like a mini seizure at the moment of becoming a nida. Again, doesn't seem that's an experience that people have very often. And a third possibility is the closest one to maybe an experience that some people might have, which is shemargeshes davar lach zav mimena bifnim, that she feels some moisture flowing. But here's why it doesn't happen. Sometimes you might feel some moisture mibifnim, on the inside, meaning not when it leaves the body, but when it goes into the cervix, that she already feels some moisture flowing. So again, these are the kinds of things that we don't really have. Now, if that's the definition of Nida, that the definition of Nida is not just seeing blood, but the definition of Nida is seeing blood and having one of those sensations, one has to ask the question, how is anyone ever in Nida on a Daraisa level nowadays? We just don't have the criteria. We don't meet the criteria of being in Nida. So what the poskim generally assume is that we can't say that a regular woman who's very healthily getting her period on a regular basis is never becoming a Nida on a Daraisa level. No, what the Gemara was assuming was that when a woman gets her period, she becomes a Nida Midaraisa. It's just sometimes it's not so easy to know. Sometimes, you know, I'm not sure, is this mid-cycle bleeding, is this staining, I just changed the pill, and I don't know, is this, and it's hard to know exactly what's happening. It used to be when they had these sensations, that was the easy way to tell, because it wasn't the amount of blood that was the determinant. Afilu tipas dam kechardel, even the tiniest amount of blood, could make a woman a nida on a daraisa level. The easiest way to tell when they had these sensations was if they had it, then they knew that they were in Nida Da'oraisa. And if they didn't have it, then they knew that they were not in Nida Midaraisa. But if a woman gets her regular period and knows that it's a regular period, so you don't need these sensations to become a Nida Midaraisa level.
Idea where like things are different now, and I don't know if this is sounding like apophysis, but like isn't it possible that maybe we would know what a zava is today, or there's no way?
No, because it's, knowing what a zava is more about math than anything else. It's when someone becomes an Ida, when someone becomes a zava, depends on which time of the month it is. But how to do that cheshbin of which time of the month is a big machlokas rishonim, and we have no idea how to paskin.
So it's not like a biological.
Right, it's not a biological issue, exactly. It's the same, what we call mayon echad. The blood's coming from the same place. It's just a matter of when it's happening. For example, one opinion in Rishonim is the first time a woman gets her period, when she's a little girl, first time she gets her period, start the clock, and every 7 days, 11 days, 7 days, 11 days, for the rest of her life, it switches back and forth. So, you know, good luck tracking, you know, it's hard enough to track Vestals from 1 month ago, you know, good luck tracking that. And then there are other opinions in Rishonim that, no, it restarts every time you get your period, new 7 and 11, it's just very hard to, and we don't know how to paskin. So already in the times of the Gemara, they forgot that that wasn't a biological issue, that was a, it was just too hard to keep track of. I would bet that if they had computer programs then, like we do now, this knowledge never would have been lost. But the knowledge was lost. So we don't know how to write the program anymore. We can't do the coding anymore for such a program.
That can be understood better just because we have...
Right. Look, going back in time, if we had a time machine and we could bring a couple of coders and make an app, you know, for that time, we could probably have figured it all out. But unfortunately, we can't do that. So, so that's in terms of what makes a woman a Nida on a Daraisa level is getting the regular period. That's obviously a Nida Daraisa. You don't need anything else other than that to become a Nida Daraisa. There are other ways, though, that a woman could become a Nida Daraisa even when she doesn't get her period. For example, Chazal were concerned that even if a woman didn't feel a hargasha, but if something was going on in the body that would have covered up the hargasha, that would have masked the hargasha, that would have distracted her from feeling the hargasha, and at that moment that distraction existed, some blood comes out, no matter how tiny the amount of blood, that too would make a woman a Nida Daraisa. Therefore, what this translates to is as follows. If on a bedika cloth, even just a tiny drop of blood, now it would have to be blood, but a tiny drop of blood were to come out, even though she knows that's not her period, that's not a normal flow of blood, but since the way a bedika is done, it's the kind of activity that would mask or cover a hargasha, and she never would have felt it, nowadays that's still a carryover from the days of hargasha, that even a tiny drop of blood on a bedika cloth or on a tampon would make a woman a nida on a da'oraisa level. Now, it's important I say nida on a da'oraisa level. Normally, when we say something, you know, if you call me up with a kashrus question, you know, the chicken soup and the milk, and so I would say, okay, I would just say, it's not kosher, right? I wouldn't say, oh, it's not kosher midrabanan, you know, because it doesn't make a difference. We observe the drabanans, we observe the da'oraisas. By nida, it makes a huge difference whether we're dealing with da'oraisa and drabanan, and we're going to explain that in a moment. But first, let's go through the ways a woman can become a nida mida'oraisa. So far, we have two ways. Number one, that a regular period, a regular flow of blood, which is the obvious way. Number two, a bedika cloth or a tampon or anything in that area that penetrated a little bit would mask a hargasha, and therefore even the tiniest amount of blood that comes out on it would also make a nida da'oraisa. If sometimes the husband after tashmish will find, rarely, but might find blood on his body, that might be an indication of nida da'oraisa. Anything that can mask the hargasha going on in that area could be an issue of nida da'oraisa. A third way that a woman might be a nida da'oraisa, and it's not all that common, but it's just something to be aware of. The Gemara says that efsha lepsichas hakever below dam, which means, at least according to one opinion, but we pass on like that, which means that if the uterus is opened up, and we assume in halacha 15 millimeters or more of an opening, then we, even if you don't see any blood, we assume there was blood, nida da'oraisa. Now, what does that mean? The uterus was opened up 15 millimeters. When does that happen? So certainly during childbirth. So during childbirth, not non-C-section childbirth, that would happen. So even if for some reason we have what Chazal referred to as a lady yaveshta, that there's no blood whatsoever during the childbirth, very, very, very uncommon. But let's imagine for a moment. So that would still be, she would still be tamea, because there was what they call a psichas hakever. I still don't really fully understand why Chazal referred to the uterus as a kever, but that's what they do refer to it as. But that can't happen without blood. The other way that there could be an opening of the uterus is from certain gynecological procedures. Most do not involve opening the uterus but with a 15-millimeter instrument. But if it does happen, if there's a particularly invasive gynecological procedure, that could render a woman a nida on a da'oraisa level. So those are the three ways a woman becomes a nida on a da'oraisa level. Regular period, something that could have masked the hargasha, like on a bedika cloth or on a tampon or something of that nature, and if there's a psichas hamakar, if there's an opening of the uterus through either childbirth or a gynecological procedure. How does a woman become a nida on a drabanan level, and what difference does it make if it's da'oraisa or drabanan? Well, on a drabanan level, a person can become a nida if you find a stain, it wasn't a regular flow of blood, there was nothing that could have masked any hargasha, as far as you know, there was no opening of the uterus, but a stain was found on a garment, on a sheet, on a towel, anything of that nature, you find a stain. Chazal made a gezeira, and this is clearly not da'oraisa. Chazal made a gezeira that too makes a woman a nida, but only midrabanan. Why did they make this gezeira? Several different explanations in the Rishonim. It's all academic. You know, the explanations are all academic, are not going to be particularly relevant. For example, Rashi says, we're afraid maybe there was a hargasha and she just wasn't cognizant of it. Because remember, on a da'oraisa level, even this tiniest amount of blood will make a woman a nida as long as there was a hargasha. But if there was a hargasha and you didn't know about it because you were too distracted by something else, even though there was nothing going on in your body that would have distracted you, we still have to be concerned. Maybe there was a hargasha and you just missed it. You were on a roller coaster, so you didn't feel the the shaking of the body, if you assume that's what the hargasha is. So that Chazal goes there that a woman becomes a nida when she finds a stain. Now, because that is only a gzera of Chazal, and because it is a big chumrah, Chazal attached four very important kulas to that chumrah. Four very important leniencies that when dealing with something that's just a stain, not the regular flow of nida blood, not a red spot found on a bedika cloth or a tampon, not the opening of the uterus, something that's just a stain on a garment, there are four critical leniencies. One critical leniency is what we call taliyah, the possibility that the blood came from somewhere else. It has to be a reasonable possibility. It can't be, you know, can't use too much imagination to explain where it might have come from. You know, in our times, it would be, let's say, a yeast infection or hemorrhoids or a cut somewhere, an irritation in the area, you know, because an irritation even in that area of the body is no different than a cut on one's finger. That's not needle blood. That would not be a problem as long as there's some other explanation as to where the blood came from other than being regular needle blood that came from the uterus. Any other explanation that's reasonable, we would be lenient if we're dealing with nida midrabanan. When I say by reasonable, it doesn't have to be that you know for sure that that's where it came from, just that it's reasonable that that's where it came from. When dealing with nida d'oraisa, if you think the blood, if let's say on a bedikah cloth, you think the blood may have come from somewhere else, it's not enough that it's reasonable that it came from somewhere else. You would need proof that it came from somewhere else. That's where a bodekes comes in, someone who can check to see if there's some sort of wound or some sort of irritation in the area. But without that knowledge, that absolute knowledge, it would be for nida d'oraisa, we wouldn't be able to be lenient. But for nida d'rabbanan, we don't need knowledge, we just need the possibility. In the times of the Gemara, it was different. You know, the reasonable explanation was a woman visited a butcher shop. That was the reasonable explanation, and that was reasonable, because they were hacking away at meat and animals and whatever, and there was blood flying all over the place, and that's what happened when you went to the butcher. It wasn't like packaged in the plastic like gourmet glot, you know, with everything labeled and everything. So that was so times have changed a little bit, and times have changed even more on the second leniency. The second leniency is one probably that if Chazal were making up these rules nowadays, they never would have given us. But they made it when they made it, and therefore we have this leniency, and that is the leniency called a gris. If the size of the stain is smaller than that of what happens to be the equivalent of an American penny, even if it's pure red, and you have no other explanation of where it could have come from, but it's just a stain, it wasn't a regular flow of blood, it wasn't on a batik cloth, it was on a garment, it was on a sheet, smaller than an American penny, it's automatically not a problem. Why is it automatically not a problem? Because in the times of Chazal, they used to have something called a ma'acholas. A ma'acholas is a type of, for lack of a better term, a bed bug of some sort that apparently used to be everywhere. And when people would roll over on their sheets, they would regularly crush these bugs. And you know how, like, when you sometimes, if you squash a mosquito right after it bit you, like a little blood comes out? So these bugs would leave a stain, but not so gross, never larger than an American penny. So if the stain is smaller than that of an American penny, we assume, oh, it must have just been one of those annoying macholes bugs, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. Now, that is not reasonable to assume nowadays, thank God, that a macholes bug. But nevertheless, since when Chazal made this rule, made this whole chumrah of a kesem, of a stain, being a problem, they never included a kesem smaller than an American penny. It's an automatic heter. If, let's say, you find a stain that is small, the whole stain is smaller than a penny, a shaila doesn't even need to be asked. That's something you can paskin on your own. If the entire stain is smaller than a penny, where it gets complicated is that stains typically are made up of multiple colors, there are multiple shades in different spots, and they also don't normally come out perfectly round, where you could just, like, you know, stick a penny on it and say, oh, okay, there you go. Things are a little bit different, a little bit more complicated than that. So when things get complicated, that's when you have to ask a question. I should point out that there are different color secretions of from the body are not tameh, only if it's what would halachically be considered red. So if it's not even close to the family of red, no part of it is even close to the family of red, then a shayla probably does not need to be asked. But if there are tinges of red or something that might border on red, then a shayla certainly would need to be asked.
Is this all referring to something that's on white or any color too?
That leads us to kula number three. Kula number three is any stain found on colored clothing is automatically not a problem. But again, this kula, like all of them, is only when we're talking about a stain, when we're talking about nida midrabanan. Nida d'oraisa, a woman cannot just wear colors for the colored clothing for the rest of her life and say, oh, I guess I never became a nida. That doesn't work, because when you know that it's a regular flow and you know that it's a regular period, there's no tricking God, like you can't outsmart the system and say, no, must not be nida. No, it is nida if it is, but when it's not, when it's just a stain and it's on colored clothing, that is kula number three. That is leniency number three. So it's only a problem when it's on white. Now, that is probably the biggest of all the leniencies, because you just don't wear white, and then you won't have the problem of stains. When do you have the problem of stains? If it's during the seven clean days, which Chazal referred to as the Yemei Libun. Why are they called the Yemei Libun? Because a woman is expected to wear, during that time, Big Day Levanim. She's supposed to wear white clothing during that time, because that's during the seven clean days is when one has to sort of be on the lookout to make sure that there's no blood coming. So that's when one has to wear white. But any other time of the month, it doesn't make any sense to wear white. Why would you cause yourself trouble? So we certainly recommend that one wears colored clothing, and colored sheets, just to be safe also, might as well. And that way, if a stain comes up on a sheet, Rabbi Sablowski told me, he once had a shayla. Woman had, everything was colored, except when she took off the sheet, when she was changing her sheets, it had dripped through onto that white thing that covers the mattress. So that was white. She didn't think of that. I mean, I don't even think they sell them in other colors. It must have been pretty heavy staining, but they found. So then he had to work on the fourth kula. And the fourth kula is anything that's not mekabel tuma is not going to make a woman tame as a nida if it's a stain. If the stain is found on something that's not mekabel tuma. So how do I know what is mekabel tuma, what's not mekabel tuma? All you have to do is become a great expert in the area of Mishnayos and Taharos, which could take, 10 years or so of intense study to figure out what is and what is not Mekabel Tumah. Thank God Rav Moshe Feinstein sort of did that for us, and he dealt with all the modern applications of what is and what is not Mekabel Tumah, and he has these long tshuvas that, people usually just skip to the end. What's the bottom line? Is toilet paper yes or no? And the answer is, toilet paper, for example, is not Mekabel Tumah, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein. The pads and the like are also not mekabel tuma, but again, that only works as a kula when we're dealing with stains. If it's a flow, and you say, oh, well, it's a pad, so it's not mekabel tuma, so that's where the blood is on. It doesn't help if it was a flow of dam, if you know that it is your regular period. It only helps if it was a stain that is not the regular period. So Rav Sablowski is very complicated, because it was made mostly of synthetic material, like polyester, which is not mekabel tuma, but there's a halacha called a maimid bedavar mekabel tuma, that if something is held together with something that is mekabel tuma, like, let's say, cotton threads that hold together the polyester, then the whole thing becomes mekabel tuma. So you have to call up the company that makes the mattress pads, find out if they have cotton threading that holds the thing together. They thought he was like, oh, allergies to cotton? Who's allergic to cotton? They never even heard of such an allergy. And he was trying to come up with some sort of explanation of why he's asking these questions. I think it turned out that it is mekabel tuma. I think it turned out that...
staining so much that it went through to the mattress cover.
I don't know what the details were, but right. It sounds like it would have been enough that you would say maybe that's a flow already. See, we have to keep in mind that really, really the halacha is that it doesn't make a difference how much blood there is. That's not what determines need to darais or need to drabanan. What really determines is hargasha. The only thing is we don't have hargasha anymore, so we don't know how to tell. So what a lot of poskim will use as a guidepost, but not a real definition, a guidepost to figure out, is this a flow or is it not a flow, is the amount of blood. Because typically when it is a flow, there will be more blood, and when it's not a flow, there will be less blood. So that's why, Rabbi Willig will often say, if it was heavy enough that she felt like she had to put it in a pad, then probably it was a flow of blood, and it wasn't just nidud rabban, it wasn't just a stain. I'm always uncomfortable with that as a definition, because every woman is different. Some women are very, very, the second they see anything, they just might as well be safe and put a pad in. And so what? So she sees a tiny drop of blood, now she's going to become a nida d'oraisa because Rabbi Willig made that gedder, she puts a pad in. And some women have a higher tolerance for a little bit of a mess, and therefore won't put a pad in as quickly. So I don't know, I just don't, it's that's probably the hardest shayla in Hilchos Nida to answer. to figure out when you're dealing with Nida Drabban, when you're dealing with Nida Daraisa. Probably the hardest shaila to answer and the scariest one to answer, just to be quite honest, because you're dealing with, if you mess up, you're dealing with Nisakaris. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that you cry in Yom Kippur for. Like, you know, that's a frightening question to answer. Now, and the attitude of any posek in Hilchos Nida is never, you might as well just be machmir. Like, that is not the approach. The Gemara says that David HaMelech, one of the things that set David HaMelech apart and made him so great was that he said, Yodai mulchlachos b'dam shvir b'dam shilya l'tahir isha l'bayla. That he had his hands dirty with all sorts of stains that he was looking at all day to be mitahir isha l'bayla. So interesting. Why doesn't he say to paskin whether a woman is tahara labayla or tamei labayla? No, he says kedei letaher isha labayla. In order, there's a slant in the psak that we try to make to see to it that we can come up with a kula if it exists. A lot of rabbis you go to, if you ask a shaila, they'll tell you, I don't want to paskin on that. That's their way of saying I can't be makel, but maybe you'll find someone else who can, just because we're uncomfortable being machmir on something when it doesn't have to be. But at the same time, we also can't just be makel on things when the halacha is a chumrah. It's a very, very frightening area of halacha. A person needs a great deal of competence to really paskin in this area of halacha. Now, what kinds of things are not mekabel tumah? Rabbi Sabalowski gave a shiur for the men on last week, and he mentioned that a toilet bowl, for example, is not mekabel tumah. Because a toilet bowl is mechuber lekarka, it's attached to the ground. So to find blood on the toilet bowl, so that stain, a stain found in something, it's not mekabel tumah, and it's tahora. So he said he once got a phone call from someone who said they found blood on the toilet bowl, and he was like, oh, okay, good, so we have that leniency, not mekabel tumah. And he said through the conversation, it became evident that they were calling from the plane. And she saw blood on the toilet bowl on the plane. Now, the whole reason the toilet bowl is not mekabel tumah is because it's attached to the ground. It's mechuber lekarka. But when it's part of an airplane, it's not mechuber lekarka. So, you know, toilet bowls in general, unless it's a porta potty or a toilet on an airplane, or you don't get too many shilas from women in porta potties. That's only from men at football games, you know. That would be a case of a toilet bowl that would not be mekabel, that would not be mekabel tumah. But most relevant is toilet paper, tissues, pads. I remember I was talking to Rav Asher Weiss once, and I had heard that there were some people that were saying that if women during the seven clean days just wear a pad in their underwear, then they could avoid any problems of ksamim, because the pad is white, so you're not technically violating the not wearing white problem, but any stain that comes out is going to be on a pad, so it's automatically going to be fine. So I thought that was scandalous. I mean, that's the whole point of the seven clean days, is that you're supposed to know that if there's a problem and have the potential to have the problem. And so I thought that was crazy. So I asked Rav Asher Weiss what he thought. He said he also thought it was crazy, but he said, I'm glad that people have accepted my psak, that a pad is not mekabel tumah. I wrote a long tshuva on this, and I'm glad that my psak has been accepted. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein also wrote a tshuva, and I think his psak was also accepted, but I think that's the psak of the majority of the poskim. But again, very important to realize that none of these kulas exist when you're dealing with a bedika cloth, when you're dealing with a tampon. So if you're not sure what's happening, you're not sure, is it the start of a period, is it not the start of a period, so some women automatically will just stick a tampon in. That's probably not the greatest idea if you're not sure what's happening, because any blood that's found on a tampon is going to be a problem. If you stick a pad in because you're not sure what's happening and it's only a small amount of blood and it turns out not to be a flow, a lot more room to be lenient than if you stick a tampon in, because again, the idea of the masked hargasha comes in that situation. Also, a lot of times, a woman's not sure of exactly what's happening. What is this? Is this the beginning of a period? Is it not? And she'll want to know. The curiosity will get the best of her, and she'll do a bedika. Also, not the greatest idea, because then any blood on a bedika cloth is going to be a problem. It's going to be nida d'oraisa. Now, I should point out that not every time you have something that you think looks bad is it necessarily bad. I've seen shailas of things that looked very messy and very dirty, but there was nothing halachically red in there, and therefore it was mutter, it was tahara. Other times, things that didn't look messy at all, but just a tiny drop of red on a bedikha cloth, when you know how to look for it, could be could be problematic. So it's don't always assume the worst. Don't always assume that something is tameh. Could ask the shayla, and that often you'll be pleasantly surprised when you ask a shayla. Not always, there's no guarantee, but often. Well, we also recommend that when there are shaylas, don't. Sometimes people don't want to disturb. They don't want to disturb the rabbi. They don't want to. So I don't want to ask so many shaylas. So I'll just save them all up from the whole week. And then come mikveh night, I'll just an hour before I have to go to the mikveh, I'll drop off a bag with like 15 shaylas from that week. They'll all be carefully labeled, so you'll be able to paskin on each one. Not a great idea. What if the rabbi's out of chasana that night, and you already stuck the bag through the mail slot or something? I've had cases like that. Someone called me from Queens. They stuck it through the mail slot. Turns out the rabbi was in Israel, so I got to stick their hand in, try to get the bag out. But also, if there is a shayla on something happening earlier on in the week, it's always better to be aware of it at the time rather than just find out about it 6 days later. Also, colors can change over time. Better to ask it sooner rather than later. It doesn't mean that if on a day one bedika you have a shayla and you forgot to ask it and it's 3 in the morning and you can't sleep, that like, oh my God, let's go bang on the rabbi and Rebbetzin's door and make sure that they answer. If it's a day one bedika, wait till the morning. It's okay. It's not, at 3 in the morning, you want to leave it in the mailbox. It's fine. But not to just hang on to it for 6 or 7 days. So we'll close with that. And just to again quickly summarize, we discussed tonight Nida Daraisa and Nida Darabanan, essentially three ways to become a Nida Daraisa, either the regular period or masked Targasha, such as a drop of blood on a bedikah cloth or a tampon, or an opening of the uterus, even if it's with a medical instrument, as long as it's 15 millimeters in diameter and in circumference. And Nida Drabanan is when one finds a stain. But with Nida Drabanan, we have 4 important leniencies. If there's a tliya, something you can explain why that stain is there. If it's less than the size of a grist, less than the size of an American penny. If it's on colored clothing, or if it's on something that is not Mekabel Tumah. Any questions? I'm happy to take questions. No? Okay. Everyone have...
Yeah? I don't know if that. I didn't know this till you told me actually the counting to 10 thing because of the Hargasha.
Oh.
In case people don't
yeah, it's strongly recommended. It's strongly recommended because it really saves what could be a very complicated shayla because of this idea of masked Hargasha. So one of the things that could be happening in one's body which would block awareness of a Hargasha is just going to the bathroom. So if you go to the bathroom and the second you finish urinating, you immediately wipe with the tissue. So the tissue is not mekabel tumah, but if it's like right then at the second that you finish urinating, it could be that that masks the hargasha and we're in nida d'oraisa territory where it won't help that the tissue is not mekabel tumah. So what we recommend is to just wait a few seconds before wiping, and also to wipe in a normal way rather than more of an internal checking kind of wipe. I mean, what's really best is not to look at the toilet paper, but that doesn't seem to work no matter how many times you say it. So just to wait a few seconds in between finishing urinating. Even just the amount of time it takes to unroll the toilet paper and put it in your hand and wipe is probably enough. Better to wait a couple of seconds. But not to have the toilet paper ready so that the second you finish to wipe at that moment, because that could cause unnecessary shyness.
What I find, what I always find confusing is if someone is using an IUD, a lot of times you might get a consistent period, but it might not be a longer period, but it's always complicated about,
It is very complicated, yeah. When someone has an IUD, or even if it's not an IUD, when someone is on all the different kinds of pills now that, a person could get their period once every 6 months or once every... First of all, halachically, there's no problem. A lot of times I get that. Is it a problem? Is it like a mitzvah to become a nida? There's no mitzvah to become a nida. Meaning as much as the hashkafa of, the part-time and this and that, but come on, for real. There's no mitzvah to be a nida. But... With the IUD, what will often happen, and with pills also, what will often happen is the cycle will change drastically in terms of how it presents itself, you know, how the period presents itself, how often it happens. And that's very tricky to figure out what is halachically. Meaning, you said that sometimes you'll get your period, but it's not halachically a period. It's not so obvious that it's not halachically a period if it's a pattern, and that happens, you know, every month or whatever the intervals are. But you know, that's how you get. That's how you bleed on a somewhat consistent basis. So once a pattern of consistency is established, a period could be the tiniest amount of blood. If that's what happens consistently, that's how Rav Willig deals with it in general.
Yeah,
that,
but in the first period, you obviously
right,
that you weren't,
correct. You would assume that it's not right till it develops a pattern. Right, because we don't have to assume that a small amount of blood. We give the best guess, so we don't have to assume that a small amount of blood is an actual period. Unless you know that it is, unless you know that it's that's the pattern that's developing.
So what about the opposite? A large amount of blood off the schedule.
Well, off the schedule doesn't necessarily mean it's not a flow of blood. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not, because it can happen at any time. That's why I say these are indicators, but not absolute. So even a large, most of the time, poskim would be machmir on something like that. Even if it's off the schedule, unless it would have to be very unique. Each circumstance is so different, like it's very hard to, like this really has to be talked through, exactly what happened, when you last went to the mikveh, you know, how much is a lot, and you know, how consistent was it, like a little bit over a few days, like these are highly detailed issues that, you know, there's no, I wish there was like a simple answer, everyone, in our day and age, I guess always, people naturally just want, okay, just give me the rules so I can just go home with it and I'll just know, like forever, like what is and what isn't. It's there, you know, it's something that the greatest poskim of our generation are struggling with and working through. It's not the kind of thing that's a cookie cutter answer. So,
you said that there are certain gynecological procedures that, by definition, are above the 15 mark.
Not under normal circumstances, right? Not a regular Pap smear or whatever, or something like that. It would have to be, yeah. You would know that, right? You would know to ask. Usually, I would think. Okay, I'm going to have to change the date of our last one. I just got the invitation to the Reitz dinner where my uncle's being honored and Rav Schachter's being honored, and like, yeah. So I'm going to have to go to that one. So we'll have to figure that one out. But until then, yeah, we should talk about where to schedule. Okay.